Go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Evening, afternoon, morning, night, howdy, as noted. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you'll find entree to the chat room, as well as to the Listen Live button. But if you're already listening, if you need to tell your friends or something. Listen Live button at the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/chat room. And also, of course, the Listen... and Listen Live, and it's also available on TuneIn and Stitcher Internet Radio. Podcasting available at iTunes, and the podcast address is under the subdomain for this program at whiterosesociety.org. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. Back from an epic journey. Actually, it wasn't epic so much as it was... Whirlwind covers it quite nicely, really. And I had a magnificent trip to New York City. And I can now say that I understand a little bit of what all the hoopla is about. What a town. Got there about 7:30 Saturday evening. I was met by Pterodactyl from Republican30Tricks.com, who I was at Midtown, so she and I walked down, saw Times Square, went over, had a bite to eat at Grand Central Station. I love Grand Central Station. I love train stations in general because there's just something inspiring about them, and there's not much more inspiring than Grand Central Station. And we were talking while I was there about the fact that, you know, this, can you imagine something like Grand Central Station being built in this day and age of Republicans who holler, "We can't do that! We're poor!" Or if a company decided to build it, they'd want an entire tax giveaway for the rest of their immortal corporate lives, right? It was a wonderful trip. I learned a lot. I saw a lot. Had actual, authentic, no kidding, lox and bagels for breakfast on Sunday morning before heading over to the MSNBC studios at 30 Rockefeller Center. I was just a half a block down Broadway from the Ed Sullivan Theater, where they had replicated the 50 years ago today, not today, but yeah, the marquee for the Ed Sullivan Show featuring the Beatles. It was just neat. All the way around, it was neat. I saw some examples running contrary to most of the stereotypes about New York. And it was a reminder that it's not just, you know what, it's not just hillbillies that get stereotyped. This place where I live is no closer to being the, and let's remember, it was, after all, in Arkansas where the Beverly Hillbillies were from. This is no more Hooterville or Bug Tussle then or Siler Swamp, then New York City is the New York City of television. But that's how we all learn about, I guess, except by traveling, how we learn about the rest of the country. And one of the things that I found surprising was that without fail, well, out here in the hinterlands, we're told that New Yorkers are a grim and taciturn bunch who never speak on the streets, who don't make eye contact with one another, blah, 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 blah. Nothing could be further from the truth, at least as I experienced it in a very, very short period of time. One particular instance really grabbed me. The hotel was on West 55th Street. And I just decided to walk around the corner to Broadway, walked around the other corner to whichever street that was. And on the way back, a man with long, shaggy white hair and an elder and a couple of bags of his belongings had laid down in the doorway of a renovating restaurant or something and covered himself on a brutal night. It was probably 12 degrees at the moment. Had covered himself up with an overcoat. And a guy with an obvious New York accent was standing there remonstrating with him. You know, he wasn't yelling at him. He wasn't telling him, "You all right, Pops? You okay? Pops, it's awful cold here. I don't think I'd be trying to get, you know, maybe you might want to find a mission." But he wasn't giving him hell. He was caring about it. And instead of laying there, and it was and the old gentleman sat up and was talking with the other guy and becoming more and more alert. And I just sat there and watched a stereotype die. You know, the uncaring New Yorker. And everywhere we went, people were talking to each other. "Hey, how you doing?" "Yeah, good. You?" All of that. And just little moments like that are worth paying attention to. It was a heck of a trip all the way. I got in the plane. Thank you, George Carlin. You get on the plane. I'll get in the plane. I got in the plane in Charleston, the little Air Keebler, Canadair Regional Jet Bombardier CJ-200, I believe. I just call it Air Keebler, by elves, for elves. And was cheek to jowl and shoulder to shoulder with a fella roughly my same size. It was the jet was full plumb to bursting. And one row back sat our drunk. And I'd no sooner sat that, well, I smelled him before I saw him. This is not any kind of indictment of drinking or anything like that, but the guy was hammered at 12:30 in the afternoon. Maybe some people need to do that in order to be, maybe their fear of flying or what. So we get, it's about a 50-minute flight from Charleston, West Virginia, 336 air miles to Atlanta, Georgia. And as soon as the flight attendant came through, I said, "I'll take a tomato juice." And the guy said, I'll have a 7 and 7. Well, no, and it was all carried on very sotto voce. "Well, no, sir, I don't think I have that." "All right, then I'll take a CC and Coke." And he was determined. "No, I don't think I can serve you, sir. You're intoxicated." "Well, I've never heard of such a thing." And so we were off and running. And when we got out of the plane in Atlanta, he got off the plane, and "I want your name and identification number. I've never been refused liquor on a flight in my life." And you're just sitting there in the plane going, please, no scenes, no scenes, no scenes. And nobody came and arrested him or carried him away or anything, but he was muttering all the way up the jetway exit ramp, calling her everything under the sun. Oh, dear. But after that, it was actually a nice, the rest of the flight was fine, smooth. Had a wonderful smooth flight into New York from Atlanta. And got a nice evening city lighting up view. It was beautiful. It really is. And I was just as excited as I could be. And at least I can say that I still have that sense of wonder going for me. And it turned out the hotel that I was in had I was on the 12th floor, and the 14th floor was apparently a very popular dance club. Something that once upon a time would have been referred to perhaps as a disco. And after we had walked around and I'd seen a few sights, came back and thought about maybe just going up to check out the local scene, but then thought, no. Let us sit here, do our homework, let me do my reading, make sure I've got everything squared away. Because in many ways, whether it's a 7-minute segment on a TV program or a 3-hour program like this, the only way to be prepared is to try to read everything under the sun. And so I did, and I did learn, in fact, that New York is the city that never sleeps, because I was treated to the reverberations of 138 beats per minute, broadcasting downward from 2 floors above. I can only imagine how much fun it was for folks on the 13th floor. Then again, maybe it didn't have a 13th floor. Maybe I was right underneath them. But it was a wonderful time. Like I said, got up the next morning, had lox and bagels for breakfast because, you know, I had to. I mean, there's some things you have to do. And then away we went to the studios. And it was just a magnificent experience. And Melissa Harris Perry is a very genial person, both on camera and off. And we had some very nice, in-depth conversations off camera about more of the stuff that's going on here. By now, I presume most of you have seen the video of the segment. And I appreciate the kind words that many of you have offered in the wake of that moment. Got to go into makeup, got my face powdered and stuff, and resisted the urge to say, "I'm ready for my close-up, Max." We had faces, but it was a magnificent experience. And I'm thrilled to pieces to be home. Got home about 11:40 last night. Plane left LaGuardia with me in it at 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon. Then there was about an hour turnaround for the ride home from Atlanta to Charleston. And then, went up. And the fun part was the last 10 miles of the trip were a drive that was taken on a road in which you could not see either side of the road or any lines thereon. It was just a solid field of white. Oh, joy. So that was taken at lower than usual speeds up the mountain. In the interim, though, and this is one of the more interesting parts of the travel process, the ride home, Delta has started sending us one Airbus A320 per day in and out of Charleston. So the last ride home was on that Airbus A320, which beats the dickens out of that Air Keebler CRJ200. And it's, you know, it has a significantly greater capacity than does the CRJ200. Whole bunch of hillbillies going home, including a group of a group of fundamentalists who were returning home from taking Christianity to the heathens in Costa Rica. Yeah. But regardless of that, I just started talking with some of my neighbors there as we were waiting to board the plane in Atlanta, talking about this whole ongoing water disaster. And something fascinating began to happen. Because it became obvious rather quickly that people are, and I want to make sure I get the right word here, pissed off. Significantly, seriously pissed off. Do you all remember the clip when this thing was unfolding of that guy named Gary Southern with the sort of indeterminate English / Scots accent holding his bottle of water and talking about how he had a really long day, and the one gutsy young reporter from the TV station, when he tries to walk away, says, no, stop. We're not done. You've got more questions to answer. A lot of us have had long days. A lot of us haven't had showers. Well, it turns out that that young woman was something like 7.5 months pregnant at the time she was asking those questions. And that certainly puts a lot of context around maybe what was going through her mind in the moment. Because who knows, maybe she had given her baby an in utero drink of crude chlorhexane methanol that day, or maybe several. Because remember please, there were at least 8 hours, and more it seems obvious that there were more than 8 hours of this stuff going into the water supply and nothing being done about it. While one individual and I were talking, another fella came up and said, not trying to listen in on your conversation, but I gotta tell you something. And I said, yeah, sure. And he said, I've been working in the industry and delivering things up to coal prep plants for 20 years. And he said, I've seen that stuff all over the place. I've seen it on the ground. At no point in time in my entire career has anybody ever bothered to tell me it was dangerous. I said, how do you feel about that? He said, I'm scared to death. And you could see in his eyes and hear in his voice the genuineness of his concern. I said, then why don't you tell your story? He said, because I'll be blackballed. And then I'll never be able to get work in West Virginia again. And I'll have to move somewhere else, move away from the land that my family's lived on for 200 years. And it's true. It's absolutely true. That's how this place gets to be this place. The brutal, brutal, unregulated manipulation of the people by companies and corporations that are obsessed only with their own profits. And that's what we're up against here. People are scared to speak out. Nonetheless, many are beginning to speak out. Not the least of whom is Jay Rockefeller. He gave a fascinating little interview to one of the TV stations here. In it, he said, and he was asked by WCHS TV 8 out of Charleston whether he would drink the water and whether he thought it was safe. And in regard to the question about the safety of the water, he said, "No, I don't. Even if some expert group told me it was safe, I don't think I'd believe it. They can say it's not hazardous or this or that, but it doesn't mean anything. If people can't drink the water, they can't live. Everything else in the economic, social, and personal life of West Virginia just disappears if you can't drink water." "I know," he said, "there are people in West Virginia who have told my office or me that they're thinking of leaving. They're mostly people with very young babies. They look to a future of this kind of lack of regulatory control and discipline, and they say, where I live is less important than my children growing up healthy." It just gets into the degree of control that corporations have over people. They dominate in West Virginia's life. Governors get elected, and I was a governor once, he said, and they appoint people to regulatory jobs who help them in campaigns. What does that tell you? Of the lack of inspection of the tank farm where Freedom Industries started this whole disaster. He said, "It may not be a criminal act, but it ought to be, in this case, on the part of the state or federal government, and certainly on the part of the company." Notice how the company came last. What's really fascinating is if you go to WCHSTV.com and go to their raw news section and watch the entire interview, you'll notice that there's a word he never uses. One little word. It's the dirtiest four-letter word in the English language. C. It's the C word. C-O-A-L. He'll talk about how companies and corporations have a stranglehold on the government of this state, but he still will not dare say coal. When I'm pretty sure that the stranglehold that companies have on this state is not from the unicorn sparkle pony fart energy sector. Right? But in the course of all these conversations, and especially the gentleman who said he dared not speak up even though he's scared to death that he's probably been poisoned for years on end, lest he be blackballed and never be able to work again. By the way, did you know that's illegal, blackballing? Yeah, it is. They do it anyway. Massey, now Alpha Natural Resources, is, if you interview some former employees, notorious for this kind of conduct. But anyway, it got me to thinking about something that I've experienced a number of times over the years, where you'll reach out and talk to somebody and say it's a business owner, and say, "Look, you got to speak up against what's happening here." I mean, we experienced this trying to do a little work over in the tourism area of Fayette County. You got to speak up. You got to speak out. This is a moral, ethical, and a business issue. And almost without fail, the response you get is, "Yeah, but this is the coal industry we're talking about, and if we speak out, they'll put us out of business." Huh. How about that? A lot of people didn't speak out. A lot of businesses didn't speak out. And they got put out of business anyway. There's a rough estimate that the shutdown of business in the few days after the disaster began to unfold, when everybody was shut down by the health department, that cost economically something on the order, and I would submit that this is a low ball number, because it doesn't take everything into account, something like $61 million. Now, that's not taking into account their plumbing, their water fixtures, their water heater, all the things that work around that, the health care costs of people who may later find out that they've been toxically exposed and have medical problems as a result. None of that's in there. This is just $61 million worth of lost business. They didn't speak out, and the coal industry killed them anyway. Because this is, even though Jay Rockefeller is afraid to say the word coal, and even though Gert, and I know I don't have the time in my life anymore to, every time I want to reference him, say Governor Earl Ray Tomlin. We're just going to call him Gert from now on. Even though Gert ran right out there while he was, before he could, well, this is not a coal problem. There's not a coal mine anywhere near here. That's what Gert said. But the chemical never would have been here if it had not been needed in the coal preparation process. So, yeah, it's a coal problem. And we've got this stuff all over southern West Virginia and have no idea what its effects are, what concentrations it's in. Nothing. This problem's not going away. Now the Charleston Tourism People, Convention and Visitors Bureau, I think that's what it's called, is beginning to panic a little bit because, you know, organizations would occasionally book a convention in Charleston. It's not a terrible... Charleston's a cute little riverside city in the Mid-Atlantic region. It is reachable from just about everywhere. The hotel rates are not ridiculously expensive. There's some decent restaurants. Okay nightlife. I mean, it ain't New York. But it's okay. And so you'll get the occasional convention. Guess what? That's over. And that is to be expected in boom-bust mono economies. Eventually, they take out everything. And it's right before they bust and just wipe out what's left. So now they have. The article I read noted that Charleston likes to think that it competes with, and I laughed, frankly. They said, well, we compete for convention dollars with cities like Lexington, Kentucky, and Nashville. And really, I spit-taked on the word Nashville. If there's an organization out there that can't decide between Nashville, Tennessee, and Charleston, West Virginia, I don't know, maybe it's the... Association of retired clowns, but there's no comparison. Lexington, Charleston, I can halfway buy that. But whoever Charleston thought it was competing with, it's out of the race. Charleston is, because who's going to want to come and do a convention in a town where even Jay Rockefeller says he wouldn't trust the experts if they said the water was safe? At the end of the day, one of these days, somebody's going to have to say, listen, we're going to have to replace the whole water system all at once. Yeah. A couple of more recent developments in the ongoing water disaster. It turns out that the U.S. Chemical Safety Board, according to an article today by Ken Ward over at the Gazette, and what in God's name do we have to do to get this man a Pulitzer? He has uncovered the fact that the U.S. Chemical Safety Board had evaluated the chemical storage tanks at Freedom Industries. And it didn't take the U.S. Chemical Safety Board very long to figure out that the tanks didn't meet industry standards. And that was in October that they reviewed the tank farm. A well right? Well, so they didn't actually inspect the tank that had the tens of thousands of gallons of crude methyl chlorohexane methanol in it, but they did, for instance, examine some of the other tanks. There was a field hearing by the House of Delegates Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure, and Chemical Safety Board Chairman Rafael Moore Erasso said the tanks in use at Freedom Industries were over one half century old. Considering the best way to improve the safety of tanks at facilities that have similar tanks in use is an important question. They also showed the, and see, you know, we've talked a lot about on this program about how utterly, completely, totally useless the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection is. Well, at this hearing, they showed a blown-up poster of a photograph taken by the WVDEP that showed two little holes in the bottom of the disaster tank of MCHM. Yeah. Let's see, some of the fun facts. Company documents further show that the wall was not lined and that tank 396 rested directly on porous material, including gravel and soil. Oops. The secondary containment wall provided very little protection from a possible release. And of the October 13th evaluation, CSB lead investigator Johnny Banks said of the October 2013 inspection, there was some concern about the condition of the tanks. I imagine. But not enough concern to make GIRT order or pursue a cease and desist or anything like that against his campaign contributors. Rafael Moore Erasso also told the panel, while there are laws prohibiting polluting to waterways with a spill, there are not really any clear mandatory standards for how you site, design, maintain, and inspect non-petroleum tanks at storage facilities. It's good to know, I guess. Yeah. Mercy. And then there are the ongoing questions of, well, how do we deal with this? And particularly questions of, what about the children? Mackenzie May's writing at the Charleston Gazette, headline today, no end date set for use of bottled water in schools. In a way, that's a good thing. In another, it's a bad thing. Kids at schools have been drinking bottled water, and school meals have been prepared with bottled water. Sinks and fountains have been off limits. But remember, one school cook she fainted, I think, and they took her to the hospital the other day because she ran the dishwasher, which will never be okay again. Or it is not reasonable nor prudent to think it will be okay again. Liza Cordero is a spokesperson for the West Virginia Department of Education. She said, an end date for bottled water has not been established at the schools. Ultimately, that service is being provided in collaboration with the National Guard. There's an expectation they'll continue to provide it, but a final date is not determined. Is that language a little bothersome to you? It bothers me, but then again, at this point in time, just about every story about this ongoing disaster, it gives me a case of the squirming creepies. An end date for bottled water has not been established. It should not even be considered. But then this line about, ultimately, that service is being provided in collaboration with the National Guard. Does that mean the National Guard has some sort of say-so over this? You see, every aspect of government is failing in this disaster. Because every aspect of government is somehow dependent on people who think that this state exists for the purpose of servicing the coal industry and the oil industry and the gas industry, but mostly the coal industry. Liza Cordero went on and said that it was important that people understand that just because the schools are giving the children bottled water doesn't mean the tap water's unsafe. I refer to you to Senator Jay Rockefeller, Ms. Cordero, who said you couldn't make him drink the tap water. She said, we've received tests back, and even the more stringent and rigorous tests are showing the non-detect level for our schools. However, to bring peace of mind to our parents and to be sensitive to counties, we're continuing to provide that water. See, non-detect does not mean non-present. And nobody can say when or if that non-present level will be reached. One group of disgusted West Virginians has begun mailing bills to West Virginia American Water Company, who have gotten a great big giant pass so far. But they're sending people water bills who have big water bills even though they didn't have big water usage. They wouldn't, oh golly gee, no, they wouldn't try to run a little fast one on the ratepayers, would they? You know, just to make sure that corporate profits keep up with expectations of shareholders. Oh, please, pshaw. Nice note coming in from Kathy out in Arizona. She said, just watch the Melissa Harris-Perry show. Your point about how different the reaction would be if a terrorist had dumped 10,000 gallons in the water supply was great in summing up the entire problem. You really do a great job. Thank you very kindly, Kathy. Jim, via email, noting, no one will come to a city with poisoned water, period. Forget it. But maybe they can... No, there's no maybe. Ron and Raleigh writing in, glad you enjoyed your trip to the Big Apple. I found that New York City is a different place on the weekend than it is during the weekdays. I think those speechless, taciturn folks of legend are mostly from the exurbs that work in the city. P.S. got rained on in New York City during the weekday. developed a massive case of the hives. Ooh. Yeah, Devin, that's cool. Well, not cool, but that's sadly realistic. Devin writes in with a new motto for the state of West Virginia. You might have to have a little bit of backstory on this. It used to be when you drove into West Virginia, there would be a sign that said, "Welcome to wild, wonderful West Virginia." And we took a sort of pride in it. Yeah, it is. It's wild and wonderful. Then along came Senator Joe Manchin, who was first governor, and he said that we needed a better welcoming motto coming into the state, and insisted that all signs be changed to "Welcome to West Virginia, open for business." There was actually a good deal of hell raised over that, so we did get some of our signs back. But open for business. And what's fascinating is that Republican governors stole Joe's idea. And all kinds of Republicans, was it Wisconsin that was open for business under Scott Walker? So Devin sends along a note, "Welcome to the new number one poorest state, still open for poison business." Yeah. Unfortunately. Golly, Ned. So I just thought a bit of an update was in order. There's a whole lot more to talk about during the course of the program with this evening. It is, of course, Moran Monday. Let's see, the other male panelist with me, this in response to a question via Twitter from Isaac, the other male panelist with me was Jeremy Richardson from the Union of Concerned Scientists. He's the one who was talking about how his brother had such a magnificent job in the coal industry. Sheesh. No, I didn't take the train anywhere, Marty. I've always wanted to see Grand Central Station, and Tara kindly obliged in getting us over there. But like I said, we got lots of Morans for the real Moran Monday this evening. Dear, oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, me. In point of fact, I mean, really. There's the Calliope music. Step right up, hurry, hurry, hurry. It's Moran Monday on the horn. You will hear Morans you will not believe. Your ears will seem to be lying unto you, except for the fact that they are not. These are Morans, ladies and gentlemen, kiddies and cousins. Here behind this thin cybernetic veil of cybernetic canvas, you will hear Morans that will absolutely shock you, sun you, amaze you. Yes, indeed, for less than 5 cents per hour of programming, you too can experience grabby Morans, right-wing Morans, teabagging Morans, birther Morans, deather Morans, booger-eating Morans, repig-licking Morans, one and all.
come one, come all. You can't tell the more ends without a program, but this is the program that tells the more ends. You just can't tell them much. Head for the hills or you'll be up to your armpits in more ends.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And because I'm kind of a sports geek, I want to start More End Monday with Herm Edwards. Now, you know, because the world, the sporting world, that is, and perhaps to a certain extent the cultural world, is all agog right now with the fact that a most excellent college football player from the University of Missouri named Michael Sam, who is a defensive end of some talent, decided to tell the world that he is, in fact, gay. Yeah, somebody try to gay bash Michael Sam because I think he can bash back. And so consequently it's, oh my God, he might be drafted. Oh my God, there will be a gay guy in the NFL. Shh, morons. Hey, there's been all kinds of gay people in the NFL. They just happen to be closeted. Doesn't make them any less gay. But there have been some positive reactions to Michael Sam and people welcoming him. The University of Missouri, bless them, said, we support Tigers of all stripes at Mizzou. Proud of you. Bear in mind, we are talking about a sport here in which the first 4 years at a high level of play are uncompensated, essentially indentured servitude. That would be college football. But still, good for Mizzou. We support Tigers of all stripes at Mizzou. Proud of you. Good, 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 good. On the other hand, there's Herm Edwards. You remember Herm, right? He's over to the ESPN, and for some reason or another, somebody asked Herm about what he felt like having, you know, one of the gays in the NFL. And this is why I offer him up as a lead Moran nominee. This is what he said on the ESPN when he was asked about Michael Sam. You could say that this smells a little bit like concern trolling. When you go into the draft, look at it this way. I see look at it this way, and I see trouble coming. Let's say Michael Sam is not a gay player. Well, Herm, I'm sure you wish he wasn't. But he's a player that has some issues, off-the-field issues. And what does that usually mean when an NFL player has off-the-field issues? Usually that's your NFL player who's been popped for DUI or arrested for beating up on the girlfriend or driving too fast or starting a riot in a strip club. See Pac-Man Jones. Yes, alumnus. Well, I don't know if he ever actually graduated, but of my alma mater, Harvard on the Mon up in Morgantown, West Virginia, it just didn't work out at all well for Pac-Man. You know, people got dead around him, and yeah. So that's generally your off-the-field issues. I mean, because after all, there was Tim Tebow flying off to the Philippines apparently to assist in circumcisions of little poor Filipino baby boys, and nobody said he had off the field issues. But off the field issues generally refers, yeah. So Herm Edwards, in discussing the bold and brave decision of a young man to say, hey, I play football, I'm gay, get over it. Well, no, Herm's a concern troll now.
When you go into the draft, look at it this way. Let's say Michael Sam is not a gay player, but he's a player that has some issues, off-the-field issues. So he has just equated Michael Sam being gay with Michael Sam maybe starting a riot in a strip club or getting busted for DUI or getting busted for beating up his girlfriend or those off the field or maybe accidentally shooting himself in the leg with his Freedom Protecting pistol. Right. The thing you talk about in the organization with the general manager and obviously the owner is, can we handle this guy? Really, really, Herm? You ought to pay a little more attention to the goddess of irony, Herm. I know you're a fundy and everything, but are you a fundy, Herm? No, that's Tony Dungy's the fundy. And maybe you're not a fundy, Herm. I don't know. But the goddess of irony will kick you in the ass if you're careful, because here you are talking about a young man who's just come out of the closet as a pretty damn brilliant draft prospect football player, and you're talking about handling him. Yeah. She's a rough one, the goddess of irony, and she will kick your ass. Can we handle the media that's going to come along with his situations? Really? What situations is he going to have now that we're assuming that he's a woman beater instead of a gay guy, because those things are exactly the same? Huh? He's bringing baggage into your locker room. Really? Baggage? Like what, Herm? Feather boas? Disco, lighted mirrored disco balls, Herm? So when you think about Michael Sam, all of a sudden, can the players handle the media attention they're going to get when they get the question asked, are you okay with a gay teammate? Because, see, that's the thing. He's not a wife-beating, drunk-driving riot starter at strip clubs. He's back to being gay now, Herm? Jeebus. So it's no longer about Michael Sam being gay. It's about whether or not there are enough non-bigots on the football team to, is everybody going to be checking to see if Michael Sam's looking at their junk? God damn. Idiocracy was supposed to be happening 500 years. Get your hands off my junk! And then there was the typical, I guess, anonymous NFL executive. I don't think football is ready for a gay just yet. That's a player personnel assistant in Sports Illustrated. In the coming decade or two, it's going to be acceptable. But at this point in time, it's still a man's man game, baby. Man's man game? Does he even realize what he just said? It must have been like shooting fish in a barrel for the goddess of irony with this story. It's still a man's man game. To call somebody a gay slur is still so commonplace. It'd chemically imbalance an NFL locker room and meeting room. I know it's going to make no sense whatsoever, but I just have to say this. Oddly enough, that response reminds me of what coal people in West Virginia say about renewable energy, wind and solar, because I've heard it. Well, that wind and solar's fine. We might, 100, 200 years from now, we might be able to use some of that wind and solar alongside our clean coal electricity. But right now, the technology just ain't there to have that clean, no renewable green communism-inducing solar and wind energy. We're just not ready for it yet. Same, same. Eventually when we feminize the game and make them play football on ice skates, maybe, well, then maybe we can have a gay guy in the NFL, but we're not ready for it yet. Then there's a former general manager.
They will break a tie against that. That will break a tie against that player every time. Yeah, him being gay. Unless he's Superman. Why? Not that they're against gay people. It's more that some players are going to look at you upside down. Well, you know, if somebody's looking at a gay guy upside down, I don't think the gay guy's got the problem. They would maybe a little latency. Hey, would you stand on your hands for me for a minute, son? Every Tom, Dick, and Harry. See, this is a separate guy. And the goddess of irony was just flitting around like freaking Tinkerbell from one bigoted asshole to the next. Every Tom, Dick, and Harry in the media is going to show up from Good Housekeeping to the Today Show. Well, you know, those are sissy shows anyway, right? Because, I mean, Bryant Gumbel would never want him on, like, Real Sports over on the HBO or anything, I'm sure. A general manager is going to ask, why are we going to do that to ourselves? Doc, do you have a moment for this? Just a minute, please, Doc. Well, certainly, Bob, certainly. How can I help you? Well, you heard these two parents, and Herman. Bob, it is so very obvious that these fellows have mother issues and father issues and probably without Oedipus. What do you want from me? Well, I mean, that's why you're on staff. I mean, Bob. These fellows are obviously so thoroughly immersed in their hypermasculine hypersexuality that they probably wear their cleats into the shower just because being barefoot would somehow make them think dirty thoughts about dirty things. How about that, Doc? And I hadn't even taken to the next quote. What is it? There are guys in locker rooms that maturity-wise cannot handle it. See, there they are again. They're handling. I deal with the thought of that, the assistant coach said. There's nothing more sensitive than the heartbeat of the locker room. Isn't that interesting? Suddenly they're talking about sensitivity. If you knowingly bring someone in there with that sexual orientation, how are the other guys going to deal with it? It's going to be a big distraction. Oh, I see. He says it's going to be a big thing. I wonder if he thinks about a lot of big things. That's the reality. It shouldn't be, but it will be. I mean, we wouldn't want to be bringing those Negroes into our white schools. I mean, there's going to be a big distraction. Because after all, you know, it shouldn't be the reality, but that's what it's going to be. I mean, your classroom is the beating heart of an educational system, and having those dark-skinned people in there is going to be a big distraction. Bob, you're getting better than this. I think you've been paying attention to your lessons. Well, thank you, Doctor. Enjoy the cigar. You know I always do. So, Moran number 1, 2, 3, 4... God, you'd think that Michael Sam was bringing dengue fever into the locker room. Oh, for pity's sakes. Marty noting, more than whatever Herm Edwards might have said, I want to hear Tony Dungy. Oh, I so don't. Marty also pointing out that apparently some draft prognosticators believe Mr. Sam is a third-round draft prospect at best. Don't scream at me. This is what I've read since Mr. Sam came out. I'd never heard of the guy personally and still don't care. Now, who was the military man who said he didn't care if a soldier was straight, only if he could shoot straight? Yeah. Lieutenant Colonel Robert Bateman pointed that one out earlier today over at Charlie Pierce's place over at Esquire.com. I mean, really, does it matter how a person cares about another person and forms relationships as long as they can deliver that punishing lick, or maybe, you know, come around to the blind side of an unsuspecting quarterback and knock the ball loose? I mean, see, this is kind of an oniony problem, because there are layers within layers here. And when you get down to that layer of, well, I don't know if the locker room can take this, that essentially says that these guys who are getting paid a boatload of money are basically just mailing it in for the amount of time it takes to be on the football field, and that they're not really that committed to winning. That they're much more concerned with, and for reasons we don't know why, much more concerned with doing fifth grade things like, or well, first grade things like checking each other out, you know, at the PP station. Which in turn is a sort of sexism in its own right, whereby everyone in a men's locker room is reduced to some sort of sexist lowest common denominator of, instead of trying to wash off the grit and the grime and get the bruises and the scrapes and whatever treated, that really it's some sort of bathhouse with Barry Manilow playing for Bette Midler back in the far corner by the Bengay station. Yeah. So you get the idea. And like I said, lots more morons. We will go to your conversations and your nominations in the top of the hour. You know the number, 304-658-3333. Via Skype, if you wish to reach out that way, Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn, Bob Kincaid Horn, and that works equally well. Email comes into Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid, @gmail.com. On Twitter, @BobKincaid, Bob Kincaid on Facebook. We interact all kinds of different ways during the program. And here at 3 minutes past the hour, a reminder, we do all of this via your kind contributions. We begin this evening with a $50 challenge from Randy, who would like a little help along the way. Among other things, we ended the week in a bit of a hole. Some of that hole got filled in, and we found ourselves starting this evening $80 at an $80 deficit, which means we need to raise $230, which means we're back to $180 with Randy's kind challenge. So he's got $50 out there to match the next $50 that comes in. So that will help things significantly. 18 people, 10 bucks apiece, 2 at 90, 3 at 60, and permutations beyond that you can figure out with a calculator better than I can on the fly. This is Conversation Radio, Country Mouse home from the big city. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn.
Chunk builds a bonfire, and Rico plays with it. Tears. Games without frontiers, war without tears.
On the horn, this Moran Monday is underway. Peter Gabriel, of course, Games Without Frontiers. And that's what, you know, I mean, that's what that Michael Sands story is all about, is breaking through some frontiers. And look, it's going to happen. And I guess we're going to, as we always do, we're going to have to deal with a certain number of Morans. It was just a week ago that we were talking about the Morans who had a hissy fit about somebody singing America the Beautiful, our national anthem, the wrong way. I guess modern media culture, including the interweb tubes, amplifies that. But it is not. It's not creating it out of whole cloth. There are a significant number of people in this country who want to help the corporate powers that be destroy this country. I include the teabaggers in that, and the libertarians in that equation, without a doubt. And a little note, here in about two hours, I'll be joining Mike Malloy at the top of his program to talk about this West Virginia Appalachian issue in some greater detail. And I really appreciate Mike giving me the opportunity to do that. I think we'll have, you could have a conversation with Mike Malloy about the relative merits of various toothpastes, and it would wind up being some of the most compelling radio you could ever hear, because Mike is just that good and has been for a very, very long time. So I'm looking forward to a chance to chat with Mike, and who knows, and Hope you'll tune in. It should be right after the beginning of the program. Mike Malloy Show, MikeMalloy.com. The live stream feed is there. And I get a kick out of watching the live stream feed. I really, really do. Let's go to the phones. A couple of lines open if you want to jump in. 304-658-3333, and away we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's John. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I got you, John.
Hey, yeah, I'm calling for my car, so if it sounds bad, we can drop to it later.
No. We're doing, you're fine.
Oh, good. Well, I'm in the mountains of Western PA, so if you lose me, that's it. But I wanted to call and just go back to the Michael Sam thing. I think it's actually really interesting. And there's a level there that's worth talking about, I think.
Go right ahead, please.
Yeah, well, it's just, it struck me, and Dave Dyron pointed this out, that all those comments from these NFL front office types, you know, and the former executives and all that, you know, that's all anonymous. You know, no one's going to put their name on it. And they are talking about the pulse of the locker room, and these are guys in the front office. These are students. These are totally, I mean, if you think about football having a class structure, these are like the totally different guys that are so far divorced from that.
Yeah, this is management, not labor.
Yeah, right. I mean, that sounds maybe that's a little too, you know, 1930s or whatever for some people. But I mean, my God, like they are saying what is in their own best interest without any attention to what the players say. Everything I've seen is that and they've polled NFL players on this, and they're overwhelmingly like, it's not a big deal. Like, we care about if people can play. We're not afraid of them.
Right. Can he slobber knock the daylights out of somebody? Come on, let's play.
Then he's going to help us, you know, win games and maybe get to playoffs, which is good for our contract. We get bonuses. If we go to the Super Bowl, hell, like, we all get extra pay. You know, that's what they care about. The front office guys care about how much of a stink are we going to get from the fans? Are we going to lose season tickets because some people are ridiculous? I mean, that's their interest. I think that, you know, I honestly don't care what former and current executives say about this guy. I care what other players say. And Missouri is a case study in how this is not a factor in the locker room. They went 12-2 last year in the SEC. Come on. And all the players knew.
Well, and that was the next question. Yeah, the team did know, didn't they?
Yeah, he told them about it. Apparently, they had like a trust-building retreat over the summer, you know, and it came out that he said it there. It was like, tell a big secret about yourself. And he said that. And the players, like, not only did they not leak it, but there was clearly no issue in the locker room because teams with problems in the locker room with starting players who are good don't go 12-2. They don't get a one win away from playing in the national championship. That's ridiculous.
And that's the absolute truth. There's another factor at work here, isn't there, John? And that is that here in the second decade of the 21st century, all these fellers that want to talk about what's going on, you know, whether we can handle somebody in the locker room, in the second decade of the 21st century, they now need to be anonymous, where a couple of decades before, it would have been former general manager Bill Thumbfingers said, well, we can't handle him in the locker room. People would have attached their names to it, wouldn't they have?
Yeah, they definitely would have, and they wouldn't have cared about the players. I mean, what, you know, say what you want about the NFL. I mean, the NFLPA is a pretty strong players union as these things go, you know. Players have a voice, and I'm ready to hear the players' voice. You know, I know it's the front office that makes draft decisions, but I mean, I've got to be looking at, you know, the record of the team he was on, his stats, and like how they did, and his prospects, and how he does in the combine. I mean, that's, if I'm a fan, and especially if I'm a player, that I want to see, is this somebody I want on my team because of how he does? I mean, I honestly think the report, that ESPN reporting, and I think it's incredibly irresponsible and completely misses the point.
Well, I think you're right in that regard, and I would assume going all the way back, not just to the team at Missouri, but Missouri itself is probably a pretty open campus, isn't it?
Well, you know, I did go there, so...
Well, that's kind of why I'm asking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, I mean, when I was there, there was a big move to, you know, like, universities have, like, non-discrimination policies, right? You know, we won't discriminate against students or faculty in hiring and whatever on the basis of X, Y, and Z criteria, you know? The big issue when I was there was whether the system, the Missouri system, was going to include sexual orientation in that non-discrimination policy. This was, like, the mid-90s. And it was a huge issue. I was on the paper, you know, this was like what we covered for 2 years, and they finally did. So they got that on the books, you know, like in the mid to late 90s. Active, gay student organizations. I mean, it was not I don't recall overt sort of, hate crimes issues. I mean, you know, Columbia, Missouri is a little island of progressive thought in the middle of an increasingly insane place.
I remember Columbia the same way back when I was riding my dinosaur back and forth between Fulton and Columbia. But to go back to your previous point real quick, John, all of these anonymous remarks were published in the pages of Sports Illustrated. Is that just a worn out old journalism model, or is that just a bad journalism model to say let's go print a story based on a bunch of anonymous sources?
Oh, it's bad. I got no use for SI, honestly. Like, I don't see why we need SI when we've got Deadspin, and Dave Zirin, really. But, yeah, no, it's bad. It's crappy journalism, and it's sensational, and, you know, there's a big chunk of the sports media world and the sports ownership world is very, very stuck in a bygone time. These things sound exactly like what the military brass said when they wanted to include black soldiers, and then later women. It's the same argument, just on the field as opposed to on the battle, you know?
Yeah, right. And we don't know if white people will fight. We don't know if them black people will fight side by side with white people. I mean, we don't know.
Yeah, exactly. And that was what the general said. And meanwhile, the combat folks and the soldiers were all like, look, this is not part of the equation. You know, we don't care about this. We want to live. And if they can help us, then we want them. You know, it's the same. It's that same class structure thing going on.
Well, I hope this turns out to be a tempest in a teapot, and I hope the young man is drafted appropriately relative to his skills and his talents. And then I simply hope those hypothetical locker rooms just prove it to be wrong. But by the same token, a lot of that is, to be fair, going to depend on how the for-profit media behave. Would you care to prognosticate one way or the other on that? I mean,
I don't have a sense of the landscape. I think, I mean, if they're honest, then the combines are going to say something, you know. But I hope you're right. I hope he gets drafted appropriately. I hope he goes to the Packers. And I hope that he's accepted, he does well, and 25 more players come out next year. That's what I hope.
That would be beautiful. But and I guess what I was getting at, John, is that I hope that let's assume he gets drafted and let's assume he plays. I don't want to hear, ooh, gay defensive end just put the smack down on, because, you know, nobody ever talks about straight quarterback Peyton Manning just made a big completion over the middle. And I just,
no, but you know, it's going to be, and there's going to be lots of little giggling with phrasing like, oh, good ball handling, that sort of thing. And that's going to be obnoxious, but hopefully.
Bill, was there more to it when he just smacked that guy's butt?
Yeah, right. And hopefully his performance will make it very obvious, and some cooler heads will be like, guys, just STFU and just cover the damn game, you know?
The NFL maintains pretty strict control over the broadcasters. I mean, it's like some sort of state-run media in a totalitarian state. A broadcaster can't even say, wow, that call sucked, and can't criticize the refs. Can't. Not a lot of free speech going on in the broadcast booth of an NFL game, or a college game for that matter. But I hope they take it in hand, and we don't have to put up with a bunch of shenanigans out of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would imagine NFL being what it is, if he does get drafted, it looks like he's going to play. There'll be a pretty strict guideline set down. It'll be the Sam rule, and the first idiot that decides to violate it, if he's dealt with quickly, that would probably shut it down, you know, and he should be.
Which means that that betting odds are now open on who the idiot will be.
Oh, that could be fun. Yeah, someone could really make bank on this in Vegas. That's a great idea. My money is on Vern Lundquist, personally.
Oh, okay. Betting is now open. The wagers are now open. Dr. John has Vern Lundquist.
I think that's a good choice. We'll see. He does well in college, but you know, maybe they'll let him in. I don't know.
Let's see. Is Al Michaels still doing football?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think Joe Buck would do it. I think Troy, we're pretty safe if he's still calling. So yeah. I'll take a long shot on Vern. That's my choice.
Okay. The terms of the wager have been established now. Texas Betsy just sent me a note. Whoever wins the wager pays $20 to the horn. Or no, she says whoever loses.
Hey, I liked it.
Yeah, whoever loses, whoever's broadcasters don't turn out to be the first idiot. They contribute $20. Whoever wins gets to name the sports segment of the show for a month.
I love it, and this is the first time I've ever been sad that Rush Limbaugh got knocked off the NFL broadcasting.
I think we would have had to odds on Rush Limbaugh doing it would have had to been made like 1 to 100. You'd have to bet $100 to win one.
You're absolutely right. Listen, I'm gonna lose you, so I'm gonna go. But you looked great on MSNBC. Awesome job, and I'll talk to you later.
All right, thank you, John. Thank you very much. Bye now.
All right, cheers, Bob.
Dr. John from the road somewhere in the wilds of Western PA. Our second bet has come in. Wager. Let's be gentlemen, gentlefolk about this. Marty has Chris Collinsworth. Now it has to happen inside of an NFL broadcast. Because and it's okay. It can be a play-by-play person, or it can be a color commentator. Well, you know what? It could even be a sideline reporter. I would be surprised if there was not a wager placed on, say, what's her name, Erin Andrews, right? See what I mean? Yeah. But so far we have Chris Collinsworth and Vern Lundquist. Let's keep it rolling. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, what's happening, Jeremy?
Hello. Oh, hey. So I wasn't really terribly surprised to hear that people's water bill went up when they weren't using their water. I mean, the water company's got to make a profit on both ends. They're probably smiling when this happened, honestly.
Yeah, now something I didn't mention but is equally interesting is the fact that a full-page ad went out in the Charleston Gazette, I think, over the weekend saying, West Virginia American Water is a neighborhood company that's been here for 130 years. No kidding.
Right.
Their articles of incorporation were filed in, I believe, the 1980s, I think, is what the data was from the West Virginia Secretary of State's office. And I'm pretty sure that wasn't when we started registering corporations.
Huh. Well, now that this probably has been, I noticed this a couple days ago, and I've noticed a couple stories pop on it, and I'm surprised that Fox isn't screaming into the night about it, but Victoria's Secret is on the verge of hiring a transgender model.
Really?
She was one of the final three contestants on RuPaul's Drag Race a couple years ago. I can't think of her name at the moment. But she has an overwhelming number of signatures that Victoria's Secret feels compelled to hire her for their next supermodel. And if you saw this woman, you wouldn't know. And she's quite good looking. So, like I said, I'm kind of surprised I've heard this on Fox. And I saw a couple different interviews.
Oh, they've got a hissy backlog right now. They've got so many hissies to throw that they can't keep up. I mean, my God, in the stack here, I've got the hissy thrown on Radio TV Rwanda by Laura Ingraham, in which she stated that Puerto Ricans are not American are not U.S. citizens.
Right, even though they're one of our outlying territories. I guess I don't understand her idea either, her reasoning.
Well, she was bootstrapping the hardball by way of trying to offer up Justice Sonia Sotomayor's Puerto Rican heritage as a reason why she don't love America.
You know, Laura Ingraham only wears them big hoop earrings to hold her fucking head down so it doesn't float away. Because she's a hothead airhead.
Yeah, don't just throw those things out there. And give a guy a little warning here.
Sorry, this just popped in my head. Evil things pop in once in a while.
I understand completely.
But, there's something else I called about. No, I'm lost. Well, there was that, and then, you know, I lost my track of thought now that we dropped Laura Ingraham on the subject.
Well, I'm sorry I did that to you, but you know, Laura Ingraham will kill brain cells.
Oh, yeah. That's what it was. I can't name who it was, but this person, it was one of those situations where you don't want to listen to it, but you force yourself to listen to it because you want to see where it's going.
Yeah.
It happened to flip on a news talk channel the other night, just in passing by, because there's a show which I won't mention on this program, but I listen to it occasionally because of a host that hosts it once in a while. But anyway, the person on there was throwing a hissy fit about Jay Carney's announcement last week about how this new health care system is good for people because they don't have to be stuck to their job anymore in fear of losing their health care if they leave their job, because now there are subsidies for people who want to go start their own business or venture into something else. So they're not tied to their job anymore. So, of course, this ditto head guy had another guy on. And the beginning of this program, I tuned in just, like I said, by chance. And he said he had won this award, a stack of different awards. And I can't imagine who gave me his awards, because he took what Jay Carney said and turned it into the most vicious lie that you could be. Basically, that this is going to make Americans lazy, and it's going to destroy the workforce, and it's going to get all these people just leave their jobs and stop working for free Obamacare, which isn't anywhere near the truth. Not even an iota close to it. And I heard that, and just I had to turn it off because it was enraging me. It was one of the things I had to listen to because I knew where they were going with it, and I knew they were going to try to flip around what Jay Carney had said and how the president had said it. If you look at the facts, what the president said makes sense. If you really look into it, it's not just some hoopla that he threw out there that with the new format of health care that you don't have to be tied to a dead-end, crappy job just to keep your health care anymore. There are more options now, especially with the no...
Yeah, and there are more permutations too, Jeremy. Because do you remember that one town hall that Dim Leader had a few years back, when the woman got up and began telling him her life story and said, "And I work three jobs," and Dim Leader said, "It's uniquely American, ain't it?" Right. Well, maybe that woman who works three jobs can knock off of one of them and only work two. That's part of that figure. You know, working simply to have health care, you know what? An enlightened society would say that that's not a good way to go. To have people out... No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you're absolutely right, they wouldn't. It just, like I said, it's one of those things that I didn't want to listen to, but I forced myself to listen to it because I knew it was going to be irritating and enraging, and I just turned it off and started shaking my head. The sad thing is that you, me, the rest of the horn, probably most of Malloy's group, would not buy into this kind of crap on the rainiest of all days. But there's a ton of people out there who will just shake their head. Yeah, yeah, they're killing jobs. They're going to make people lazy. Welfare, Cadillacs, Porsches, steaks, everything you can think of, they're going to throw on this one. And I was telling, I have a shrink, obviously. I've told people about some of my issues, but I have a shrink today. And also I said, I hope to God that a certain party, and I tried to be as politically correct about it as I could, will not take this whole system down with them, because they're terrified that once the American public gets a hold of this new healthcare system, that they're going to actually enjoy the benefits of it. And they're really trying to harpoon it right now to stop that from happening. I said, I don't want to go back to the old system of where you can work a 40-hour job and you're not required to have health insurance. Thankfully for that, like I said, since that mandatory thing took effect, I'm now fully covered, no matter what I do, as long as I keep working my job with my boss. And I enjoy my job, I enjoy my boss. Even though we disagree on some things politically, my health care is fully covered, and it's the highest level you can get. And he has no problem with doing that.
Yeah, I mean, here's a
same point.
Here's a classic case in point. Texas Betsy just dropped a note in. She said, I would have quit the fifth grade job last year and made a goal of expanding the Hebrew school and tutoring if I hadn't needed the health care. You know, and it was not a secret. She despised that job. But you got to have the health care.
Right. Right.
Exactly.
And that's just, I really got my fingers crossed that we don't slide back into the old shitty system. I really do. I mean, I know they tried 40 votes. Who's to say they're going to try another 60 more to try to shoot it down? That's their main goal in life. And God help the next president that comes in on top of this.
Well, I'm not capable of, I'm absolutely not capable of engaging in a discussion about the presidential race in 2016. I may spend the entire campaign, 2015 campaign season just rolled up in a fetal ball sucking my thumb. I can't tell you how I'm beginning to dread it.
No, I think we all are, because I don't think any of us enjoy the prospect of another dynasty being in there, being a Clinton or a Bush or even, at this rate, Chris Christie. I mean, people look at me now and they're like, do you want Chris Christie? I said, hell no. Well, you must want Hillary. She's Benghazi. And they still want to pound on that. I was telling people last Friday night after the Molloy program that I had heard a new guy to a building I'm working in, and he looked at me straight-faced and said, you know what? He goes, I know you lean left and you'll watch NBC or Fox. But he goes, I watch Fox because they had to have been called out by now if the things they said really weren't true. And I just kind of gave him a blank look, like, okay, nice that you think that, and I walked away. I didn't say that to him, but I just kind of thought to myself, I'm like, have you never been called out before? What about Megyn Kelly and White Jesus and White Santa? And then other things she said, or things Sarah Palin said on Fox, like, I can see Alaska from my front porch. Hello? They've never been called out? They get called out almost on a daily basis at this point.
Oh, good God. Yeah. It's... No, go ahead.
But right there, that was proof of the rampant brainwashing that nothing they say can't be that factual because it wasn't called out by it, or someone would have said something to stop them from doing it. Well, no, they wouldn't, because they're bringing in a profit with all the commercials they planned off of it all. That's all they're about, is the profit. I mean, it's just like when Beck left Headline News and then ended up leaving Fox. He said all along, don't let them tell you they forced me out. Yes, they did. His commercial ratings went down. What he was selling went down because of his craziness and his just over-the-top, oh, my, it's all white people. That sank his ship.
Yeah, and...
they didn't care that he said it. They care that he took the revenue from them.
Right, sure. But that's why it's...
If he stood up there...
It's everything. Eventually, everything, Jeremy, is about the money. Isn't
right.
it?
I mean, if he stood up there and gave a full-on Nazi salute, as long as he's bringing the money, they wouldn't stop him.
No, as long as the money stays right, everything's good.
But I will clear the lines. I just wanted to let out a couple of those rants. No answers, just rants.
Well, sometimes there aren't any answers. And sometimes you have to identify a problem before you can try to solve it.
But mostly I wanted to put out there that Victoria's Secret's on the verge of making a monumental, historic change in their system, and it's partly due to the people nipping at their heels to do it.
Indeed, indeed. Jeremy, have yourself a good evening.
You too, thanks.
All right, later.
Bye.
Bye. Jeremy calling from Vermont. And we roll onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
I like to be in America. Okay, baby, in America. Everything free in America. For a small fee in America.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's probably what Laura Ingraham hears in her head whenever she hears the word Puerto Rico.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I remember seeing that thing when I was just, a boy. And I will never forget
West Side Story, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Rita Moreno did a wonderful job with that. And, you know, it basically, even back in 1957, typified the types of discrimination and the way people made to feel who came here from Puerto Rico.
Yeah, it's pathetic.
Well, it still lives on. But, you know.
But you know, Laura Ingraham is living proof, Jim, that there's a lot of money to be made in bigotry yet in the United States.
Well, I'm certain there is. Absolutely. Certainly. I mean, she is a real trip, isn't she?
But the underlying everything of the whole Laura Ingraham business is that you know, she insulted every American in Puerto Rico solely for the purpose of attacking the justice of the Supreme Court.
I know. It's just incredible, that woman. She's absolutely a Medusa. If they were to cut her head off and her blood were to spill on something, golly knows what would spring from it, you know?
I figured she'd just grow three more. You want to work the Medusa side of the street, I'll take the Hydra.
Well, at least Medusa's a little bit easier, and as long as you keep the blood out from hatching whatever those things were. But pursuant to your program on Sunday, you did quite well. You acquitted yourself very well, and you know, we're quite restrained and used the words that I didn't want to be overly strident. But nonetheless, you got your point across. I'm glad you did, really.
I couldn't let it go, Jim.
I compliment you.
Thank you. Thank you very kindly. And what happened is during the break, we were all talking, and I simply said, I'm a reasonable fellow and not prone to histrionics. But there are things about this disaster that simply make you want to run screaming into the night because there are no answers. And after a while, when you got no answers, you got nothing left.
Well, I think the hostess of your show used those exact words, run screaming into the night.
She did.
So, you know, obviously you have some impact there, and I hope you will be back and will be able to furthermore illustrate the problems that are abundant in the place where you live.
Well, I'm working where we live, Jim. I mean, you know, you're in the sacrifice zone too. But the fact of the matter is, I'm hoping, you know, I'm proud of them for staying on the issue. Because, I mean, for instance, over at Radio TV Rwanda, apparently this never happened. And they dare not report on it. CNN is finally noticing that something happened.
Oh yeah, they are.
But they haven't yet. I don't think parachuted Anderson Cooper in. We'll know it's serious when they do.
Well, I mean, he's no barometer of that. I mean, he's very prominent with CNN, but nonetheless, I'm sure that when the time comes, he will get on this too. Absolutely. And, you know, going into this thing about the football player, I mean, you know, look at the American Skating Federation or whatever they call it. And look what they did to Johnny Weir.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, this guy's openly gay. I mean, he had these costumes done that were not exactly like Evan Leschichek or whatever. But nonetheless, the guy's he's a fantastic skater. There's no question about it. And, you know, he was just dropped from the Olympic team. Even when he was able to compete in the Olympics in, I think, Seattle 4 years ago, I believe it was, that he had to, no one would want to room with him.
And see,
room with, a girl.
And some of that stuff, although there's been a lot of positive statements coming from actual NFL players, Jonathan Vilma of the New Orleans Saints, a linebacker, he said, he's not particularly happy about it. He said, imagine if he's the guy next to me and, you know, I get dressed naked, taking a shower, the whole nine, and it just so happens he looks at me. How am I supposed to respond? Well, how can you tell if he's looking at you unless you're staring him down to see if he looks at you? Doesn't this open a few doors, Jim?
I mean, yeah, it does. I mean, you know, like...
Why are you looking at him to see if he's looking at you? I mean, pretty soon there's going to be music and somebody's going to be hollering, John, Marsha, right?
I guess so. I mean, you talk about doors on closets, I don't know. But nonetheless, it's just incredible.
Well, it sounds like Jonathan Vilma's is kind of a beaded curtain.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? But who knows? These people in the NFL and the way they have got that thing so locked up, and, you know, it's become like a statement of the state. But, you know, I point out Johnny Weir to make you realize, or to hope you will realize, I'm sure you do, that it's just not the only sport.
Oh, no, by no stretch of the imagination is it the only sport.
Absolutely not. And, you know, they did have Johnny Weir from Sochi, who was one of the commentaries on the figure skating events, and he acquitted himself quite well. And, you know, I've seen the program on Logo, Be Good Johnny Weir, and it really goes through the whole documentary of this young man's life and the stuff he's had to put up with. And, you know, his greatest population, as far as fans are concerned, are in Japan and the Russian Republic.
And there's no small amount of irony in the fact that he's got a big fan base in Russia.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, his coach was Russian. She was a former Soviet, a very highly ranked Soviet coach, and she took him on and, you know, taught him a great deal, and he's done quite well. And, you know, the guy has almost been driven from figure skating. I mean, how much longer can one... He's in his late 20s now, or middle 20s, and, you know, you only have so many years in that particular thing. I mean, with the exception of Pushchenko, who's 31, who did a very good job last night. I mean, for a guy who's had numerous operations and a spinal implant, he did wonderfully well. He did skate very well, but nonetheless, he's an accomplished skater. But I have just seen the things about Johnny Weir and other athletes, and I mean, these people train very hard for what they do. I mean, for them to be able to get out there on the ice and do what they do, my God, I couldn't do 0.01% of it on dry land with good shoes on. I mean, it's just incredible. The grace, the agility, and the skill, and yet they're going to make comments about a guy skating outfit the way they did about Johnny Weir, and, you know, that he was practically almost boycotted as far as rooming accommodations in Seattle. I mean, that ought to tell you where we've been and where it's coming from.
I loved the let me see if I can find it real quick. There was a video that was produced, it was produced by Peter sent it to me, Peter Godbold, produced by the Canadian Diversity Commission or something like that. and it showed a team bobsled. No, team luge. It was team luge. A team luge team preparing to take off, and, you know, they go back and forth and back and forth,
mm-hmm.
and it was all shot in slow motion, and there was music, and at the end, as the lugers hurtled off down the course, the Canadian Diversity Commission just put a graphic over the top of it that said, the Olympics have always been a little bit gay. Let's keep it that way. Just as a response to the homophobia that's on display in Russia. And that's a way of not being outraged and at the same time sort of tweaking the people who are. Because at the end of the day, it's about athletic prowess, not about, I mean, really? Because I guess it's the notoriety, isn't it, Jim, that makes people want to know what the rest of somebody's life is like? Because generally speaking, if we go out to, let's say you go out to buy a car, and, you know, you're kicking the tires and making sure the fit and finish is really good, you don't sit down in the car and say, huh, I wonder if the person who installed the transmission in this was gay.
Huh.
Right? I mean, you don't. I wonder if this washing machine was built by a gay person in China. Because it doesn't matter.
Well.
But because of celebrity, for some reason or another, people want to feed vicariously off their lives. And just to see, for instance, a list with regard to Michael Sam of just random, you know, not from anybody's, just nobody's out there, just ordinary bigots out there in the Twitterverse, it's hateful, it's vile, it's nasty. And you get the idea they're tweeting this stuff just to get picked up in an article by the Huffington Post.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's very hurtful, too.
It is very hurtful.
But the thing is,
we've created a culture where there is some sort of perverse value in trolling.
Well, you know, for those people who are interested in fashion, theater, music, or whatever, I mean, let them go start picking around in that. I mean, for example, we don't have any problem every 4th of July in using Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture.
No, heck no.
And he was gay. As a matter of fact, the man was so driven by despair, he drank poison, or not poison, but it was poison, river from the Neva, because it was during a cholera outbreak, and he died of cholera.
Some Tchaikovsky. Was there a Pathétique?
Yeah, the Pathétique, yes. That's
that. And I remember listening to that and just wanting to crawl into a hole and die.
Well, he did just incredible things. I mean, he had a very tormented life because of his sexuality. One of his sponsors, so to speak, was a lady whom he never met, and the only reason she sponsored him was because they would never meet. Her name was Von Meck or something. She lived in Poland, if I'm not mistaken. Someone can correct me. But nonetheless, this guy did an incredible job with contributing to Russian music. And that concept
expands, Jim, because, you know, I think of the possibly apocryphal story that's told about John Barrymore when they asked him about how he played such magnificent death scenes. And he said, dying is easy, comedy is hard.
Yes, true.
And most comedians will tell you that, you know, funny is a way of putting off the horrors, the sadnesses. And with great artistic talent also often come tremendous demons. Look at Philip Seymour Hoffman. I hated reading that story, but it's time and time again. And to go back to extend your idea regarding Tchaikovsky, nobody's walking by the David at the Uffizi and saying, homo.
No, they're not.
No, you stand there at a great distance, and you're knocked down by the power of it, or a painting, or You know, my favorite painting in the National Gallery in D.C. is Raphael's Bindo Altoviti. And he paints this young Florentine banker who had been separated from his wife and sent to do business with the church at Rome. And he paints and he paints him in almost loving terms, because it was going to go home to remind his young wife, with whom he was very much in love, that, you know, that he was in her thoughts and she in his. And, you know, it was in a style that was kind of shocking, because it wasn't just patently virile. You know, here's a young man with the flowing hair. He's got one hand on his shoulder displaying his wedding ring. And nobody walks by that and goes, I wonder if he's a sissy.
Well, that's true. You know, one of the most impressive things I saw when I was in Leningrad at the time was Tchaikovsky's tomb, or his burial place. And there was a bust of him. And whoever did this did a marvelous job. They really did. And, of course, there's an angel spreading her wings behind him. And it's a very moving particular site to visit. I mean, it's just incredible. And even the Russians today, they keep everything where he lived, the hairbrushes, everything, his dressing table, his home, is maintained at the National Museum. The same thing with Tolstoy, the same thing with Rimsky-Korsakov. Of course, they always had to, after the Nazis went in there and used, like, Rimsky-Korsakov's house for a basement or storage thing, and they tore up Tolstoy's place, and they made a ruin out of so many places that were origins of Russian culture. But nonetheless, the Russians came back, and they restored it all lovingly. I don't think we do that here in America. I really don't think so. As bad as the Russians have been made to appear to be, I mean, they really have an incredible respect for a lot of their people who have brought them to the world's attention in the arts, in the literature, in music, in every other discipline. They really do.
Yeah.
And it's just something that I happen to think about, particularly when they did the opening ceremony for the Sochi Games. I know there have been lots of controversy about that, but all in all, to me, it was a beautiful sight and a beautiful spectacle. And they used not only, let's see, they used Swan Lake.
Well, I think what's bothered me the most about, I mean, obviously, I find the Russian oppression of homosexuality repulsive, but by the same token, you can't watch the coverage and the sort of tittering going on in the for-profit media without, for those of us who lived through it or some part of it, without feeling like there's a little bit, at least, Jim, of a throwback to the Soviet era, where we constantly made sport of the Soviet lifestyle, the Soviet. Do you see what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
That sort of, those Russians.
And, you know, what better chance could our president and first lady, what better chance could they have had than to have gone to the games at Sochi? And what better chance could it not have occurred when one of the commentators, when they brought the ladies out carrying the torches, made the comment about she had had an affair with Putin?
Oh, for pity's sake.
They did. On NBC. They certainly did. And I thought to myself, my God, what? I mean, this is a time for diplomacy, good feeling, appreciation for what these people have done. They spent $57 billion. I know everything wasn't exactly right.
Yeah, that's a stunning number, because they have spent more on this winter games than all other games combined.
And then now they're trying to make something out of the temperatures and stuff like that tonight and tomorrow. And you know, the people have done the best they could to put forth their nation in the best light possible, in spite of problems that we have, you know, referenced on this program. But nonetheless, I mean, you know, why was our president not there?
My guess is, and I'm not making excuses, I'm guessing the Secret Service wouldn't have any part of it.
Bob, that's the most protected place in the world right now. If you don't think that 37,000 policemen can ensure, in addition to the efforts of the Secret Service, could ensure the integrity of his being there, I don't know what would.
Well, the other side of that coin, though, is also the fact that I suspect, and I'm also, because I try to be sensitive to these kinds of things, I'm sensitive to making blanket pronouncements, but I think the outrage in the more prominent aspects or more prominent groups in the American gay community would have been profound.
Well, the gay people who went over there have said, you know, there's no point in protesting. They haven't been attacked in any way. I mean, the only problems I've heard they've had are opening doors that would lock behind them and some of the stuff like that. But I've heard no dealings with that, and I'm sure to God we would have heard. I mean, if they were to go so far as to say that one of the torchbearers was Putin's mistress, then, you know, I'm sure we'd have heard about that too. All I'm saying is this was Russia's chance to, and they did so very well, to demonstrate their contributions in spite of many horrible things that happened to that country.
Well, that's true, and the separation that needs to be, and I'm not saying should be separated, but it is a lesson, Jim, in trying to consider people, as opposed to people as government, and getting back into that nasty, nasty downward spiral of, you know, Cold Warriorism.
Because the
Russian people are not the oligarchs and the apparatchiks and the heavy-handed types or the people who vote for discriminatory laws by a count of what, 436 to nothing or something like that.
Well, whatever. But nonetheless, you know, there are a lot of people in this country who simply regard the Russian people and the Russians, period, as barbarians, horrible people, this, that, and the other.
Well, I tell you what, you have to...
That's absolutely wrong, because I can tell you one thing. I would not be here right now if it were not for the Russian soldiers in World War II.
Sure.
And so many other people.
The outcome would have been dramatically different. And, I mean, just in the 36 hours that I was in New York, You learned to check a lot of privilege, because I heard a lot of Slavic accents, and I had, and of course this is not the same as Russian, but I had a Ukrainian driver, I had an Armenian driver.
Oh yeah.
I think the only accent I did not hear up there was, you know, mine.
Well,
and there's probably a couple of hillbillies hiding in some borough somewhere.
Yeah, I've walked down many a street in New York, and I've seen exactly the same thing that you saw with the homeless guy and stuff like that, and even outlines of murders being chalked out on the street and stuff. I mean, you know, it's the city that never sleeps. A lot goes on there. But nonetheless, I mean, as far as the Russians are concerned, people should not be convinced so much that it's all Brighton Beach now that's completely almost controlled by the Russian mafia. No, no.
Oh, and by the way, a comment coming in from Asa out in Vancouver. He reminds us both. He says that had Barack Obama traveled to the Sochi Olympics, the right wingers would have tried to skin him alive if he spent the money to travel to Sochi. Because remember, every time he steps outside the White House, the right wing is sitting there screaming, "Oh my God, the money he's spending! We're going to go broke. America's going to collapse." Right?
No, we're not talking about him going to Hawaii on a vacation. We're talking about him going over there to try to mend fences.
But that's you. The right wing doesn't operate that way, Jim.
Well, that's the way I operate. And number one, I think it's pretty rational. And number one, you know, we've got some problems with them over Iran and also with some other situations. But nonetheless, what better opportunity could have been had for that man to have gone over there and to have shaken hands with the Russian president and for them to have had conversations on a friendlier basis because that's the basic tenet of diplomacy.
Oh, I know, but you please bear in mind, Jim, and I'm not being I'm not disagreeing to be disagreeable. Please bear in mind that this president is not allowed to do anything that a white president would do in the ordinary course and scope of the business of being president. If he had shaken hands with Vladimir Putin, then immediately Fox News would have cut to special coverage of Barack Obama, communist.
I don't think so.
I would put money on this.
They would have hoisted themselves on their own petard. It would certainly have made me feel a lot better about some of the situations in the world, because that nation is coming about, and it's coming about to be what it used to be as far as its power, influence, and things of that nature. I mean, we can't agree on
that. You say coming about. I tend to think in terms of retrograde motion, but yeah, it is certainly transforming in one way or the other.
And to be a very powerful nation. And for example, I mean, we no longer command the presence we used to have, and that's what we can't get over. There are other people who are stepping on the stage of the world, and as far as I'm concerned, a lot of the American diplomacy and what they try to do and telling other people what to do is pure hubris.
Yeah, but by the same token, I can't help but remember that some of the poisons that are wafting down over hollers in the mountaintop removal communities of southern West Virginia are Russian poisons, because those operations are owned by Russia. And this country is this area, those mountaintop removal sites are being liquidated to the benefit, to the benefit of a Russian company.
And who gave them that opportunity?
Oh, America's for sale.
Thank you. They're the first ones. The Russians didn't come over. Nobody said no to them, so you can't blame them.
Yeah, but Jim Justice who did it? Jim Justice did it. He's lauded as a philanthropist. Yada yada.
I know. I know, but he's not from Russia. He's not Russian in
any way. He sold to the Russian corporation.
Well, like I say, Bob, I mean, you were the people who gave him the opportunity.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, he's a top shelf capitalist, and he'll make a dollar anywhere he can make it.
Well, that's it exactly. No matter, and this has happened before. But nonetheless, you can't blame the Russian business community for that, because they simply took an opportunity which was given to them. And the fault lies with the person who did it. That's my only thing, okay?
All right. Jim, you have yourself a good night.
Likewise.
All right. Bye now. You can look him up. Jim Justice. He sold out his holdings to a Russian corporation, and now little hunks of lives and communities, and they get on a boat and they go to Russia. And they support the Russian steel industry, the Russian generation of electricity, yada, yada, yada. Let's see. 3 minutes past the hour. We will continue. Lines are open, 304-658-3333. The Skype line is also open. Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn, is how you reach the program via Skype, 304-658-3333, on the conventional telephone lines. A reminder, we are trying to raise $180. We have a $50 challenge on the table from Randy, which he would very much like to see a response to, as would I and as would everybody who listens to this, because that's how this all keeps going. So whether it be the PayPal button or whether you prefer the traditional mail route, either way is fine. If you're going to use the mails, just shoot me a note so that I can tell Boss Man Wayne he doesn't have to put on his spider-proof gloves when he reaches into the mailbox. Back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. How are you? This is Steve calling from New York again.
Oh, hey, Steve.
How are you doing? How was your stay up here, by the way?
It was wonderful. It was all too brief and very, very whirlwindy and really, really busy.
Okay. Well, the next time you're here, I have a couple places I would love to take you for some really good beer selections and that type of thing. So if you're up for it, if you're up for it, try to make it happen. But I saw the thing last night about the football player, and I heard Dr. John, I believe his name, was talking about the at Missouri having the sexual orientation prohibition being part of their non-discrimination policy.
Right.
You know, there's one thing that I always wish, you know, so-called LGBT rights groups would frame that argument. And they frame the argument wrong by saying that something like that, that a prohibition on discrimination based upon sexual orientation would prohibit discrimination of gay people. And while that's true, I wish people would say, would also say, it also prohibits discrimination based upon someone being straight. And I,
well, absolutely. And the fact that it doesn't, Steve, is a manifestation of privilege, don't you think?
Absolutely. I just look for the day when somebody is at a press conference or a podium where they're bickering and complaining because somebody fired them because they were straight. And I almost look for the day when somebody looks at them and says, well, you realize if there had been a prohibition on sexual orientation discrimination, that would be illegal. And I tend to kind of look at that whole issue a little bit differently than an awful lot of people, for that reason, and for the reason that, you know, Jim was talking about, you know, and I know it's almost a stereotype to say it. I don't mean it to be that way, but figure skating. I was a little bit different growing up. I was the guy in my family who played sports, who played hockey, who did all that kind of stuff. And I even had fellow gay friends saying to me that they were surprised that I wasn't into the arts and I wasn't into skating. I mean, I played hockey. I was into football. I was into sports. My uncle took me to Bengals games. And yes, I know that's a sad thing. In Cincinnati years and years ago.
Well, I mean, we all have our crosses to bear.
Well, that's a huge one to bear when it comes to the NFL.
I'll never forget Pittsburgh's Myron Cope talking. Uh-huh. The Bengals, the Bengals.
Yeah, I'll tell you, my uncle endured a lot of that. My uncle endured, I don't know if you remember, the Freezer Bowl back in 1981.
Oh.
The 60 below wind chill when they played the San Diego Chargers.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, my uncle, God love him, or whoever love him, was actually at that game, and as you may recall, even then, Cincinnati had an outdoor stadium, and he was at that game outside for the entire time, enduring the 60 below wind chill. Needless to say, my uncle's a bit of a diehard and a little bit crazy too. But you know, I was reading some of the stuff last night about the guy coming out, and I guess what you were saying earlier is I take a little comfort in the fact that people now don't feel like they can be so open about being bigoted. And you talked about the anonymous comment of the, I think it was a general manager or an owner or something like that. And then the other thing that you said, which I've always kind of found a little bit weird, because I actually played in a gay hockey league when I was in a number of years ago. Here in New York, and we had a number, it was not only co-ed, but it was gay and straight and all that, and I remember being in the locker room with straight guys, and it just never, none of that stuff ever came up, and I never had.
Right, and you know, when that's your go-to question about the controversy, Steve, doesn't that say a whole lot more about the guy who's worried about being checked out?
You know what? I could not agree with you more.
I don't necessarily want to play the latency card every time, but, you know, God almighty.
Yeah, it just kind of, I would love to say to someone like that, what do you care, number one? And number two, why do you think you're so beautiful that someone's looking at you anyway?
Okay, yeah, Steve, and I'm not trying to be prurient, and I'm not. But you're gay. I'm not. I got a question. Okay, because I don't live in the same, I don't necessarily move in the same cultural orbit. And I'm going to ask this kind of bluntly, and I hope you'll forgive me, and I don't mean to be offensive.
No, no, even if you are, I wouldn't care.
Hetero people, hetero guys, you know, the country, especially women, are trying really, really hard, and allies, you know, I like to think that I'm not a total misogynistic ass. Women and their hetero guy allies are trying to teach the cave people that it's not okay to walk up to a woman and go, hey, honey, nice tits. Okay?
Yes.
So can I just ask a question here? Let's say you're in a locker room and you're gay.
Uh-huh.
Does being gay mean that you obviously you automatically look at a guy and go, hey, buddy, nice dick? I mean,
absolutely, Bob. We just can't control it. Of course, I'm being facetious.
And you. I don't know any other way to say it but that.
No, I agree with you.
Because with the Jonathan Vilma thing, there's a presumption being made there. And that's what gets so frustrating here is that there are all these presumptions being made all over the place about how people behave with regard to their sexuality. You know, it's the old whether it's construction workers, and you know, even that is a broad generalization. Every construction worker who takes his lunch is not sitting there whistling, "Hey, honey, nice legs." You know, and I'm sorry, I'm even using an accent to do that, but. Every construction worker doesn't do that, and the idea that somehow I think I'm being reduced to wordlessness, but
you're hitting the nail on the head, and it really gets back to this group of Puritans who, you know, and again, I don't mean to find latency whenever someone is too anti this or anti that, but it just begs the question, like you said, why are you the one assuming that that's what every gay guy is thinking about? Why are you the one assuming that they're looking at you? Why are you the one assuming that they're even looking at all?
See, I remember back when Peter Godbold, in his groundbreaking program, and if you've never checked out the archives, you really should, Steve. Everybody should. But whenever we'd have one of these fundies who would, you know, and it's always the anal sex hang-up thing. And I remember the frustration one night when Peter said, is it with these people? I think he said something like, I can't even imagine what it would be like to be the sex partner of one of these fundies. Because it is, you know, when they think about sexuality in the gay community, they run immediately to the end of the race and I remember Peter saying, you know, sometimes we hold hands.
You know, really, Bob, you gotta get to the base of it here. And what it really comes down to is there are people in this country who just don't see gay people as people. They don't see them anything but maybe one step above, you know, dogs doing it on the corner.
Right. People who are not people, who are defined only by, I mean, hell, we don't even define dogs solely by their sexuality. Some of them are good for fetching birds out of the water. You know, other ones are good for protecting the home.
We don't look at a retriever or a Doberman, and the first thing we think of is, I wonder how they have sex. You know. Yeah, in the chat room here, I got a comment in the chat room here from Texas T. He says, "Ooh, Bob, Fundy sex. That'll cost you extra, sweetie."
Oh, jeez. Oh, bad images. Do you think it might have something, that there might be something? Let me step back. Think about how a lot of, you know, when the issue was race, was not that it's not still the big issue, but you know, it seems like the gay issue is, that's now the acceptable group to demonize, at least universally. I'm not saying demonizing black folk isn't still acceptable in certain circumstances, it is, but I tend to think that you know, it's now the gay folks, particularly, you know, listening to some of the stuff that you have with Brian Fisher and all the, you know, everything comes down to, you know, the gay folk. But, and really what it comes down to is sex and this kind of presumption that gay men are, they're being predatory towards children. And, you know, I think about Emmett Till. Here's a, you know, a black man who looks at a white woman. And
yeah. And in that moment, there's 300 years of outnumbered white terror. You know, because, right. Because there's all this pent-up insecurity about, you know they're going to take our women and... Jesus.
It's just, it seems to me, like you just said, it jumps right to the end of sex.
Right, and you talk about how they equate gay with pedophilia, whatever. Isn't that, in essence, isn't a modification of that, in essence, what Herm Edwards was doing on ESPN when he said, you know, let's take a guy and say he's not gay, but say he's got off-the-field issues. Well, nobody in the NFL is defined as having off-the-field issues if the things the player is doing off the field are not somehow objectionable or violative of some social norm. So in that instant, and oddly enough, I mean, I looked around a little bit, Steve, and I didn't see anybody busting Herm Edwards' chops for saying that.
Uh-huh.
But he equated being gay with having off-the-field issues, which are, by definition, would you not agree, usually either illegal or immoral acts?
Yes. The bottom line is this, like you said and Jim was talking about, and I guess I would love to ask this question to some of these fundies and say, you know, what do you think, that we sit around all day doing a couple things? We gay people, we sit around, of course, you know, crafting our quote-unquote agenda, and all the gay men sit there and ponder how they're going to steal all the straight men. I mean, what are you thinking? What do you think we do during the day? I can tell you what I did today. I had to go to court and fight my eviction from my apartment today. I don't know how else to say this. I don't know.
Well, did you at least put on a little decent disco before you left, Steve?
Of course.
Or maybe when you came back.
Yes, and of course, you know what I did? I poured glitter on my face too before I went.
Oh, okay. Well, I was thinking maybe you would maybe submit your written answer to the petition in eviction. Maybe a little Elmer's Blue All and a little bit of glitter, you know, a little sparkle.
Of course, and I of course wore my platform shoes and my bell bottoms to the court.
Sure, and you know what? One of the things I noticed in a very short period of time, and it reminded me, it was a year ago that I was in San Francisco for the first time, and on the day that the right wing weirdos were carrying around their pictures of aborted fetuses in Washington D.C. It just so happened that I got off of a cable car down at damn it, I've already forgotten the geography, down there at the bay, at the bottom of the hill, and there's 3,000 people there riotously, joyously dancing for women's rights to control the workings of their own bodies. And as between the two places, the much more enjoyable party was in the Embarcadero in San Francisco. I mean, people were jumping and bouncing, and the music was loud, and everybody was having a good time. Meanwhile, back in D.C., they were grimly and solemnly being horrified by each other's pictures of aborted fetuses. Well, the same thing, I had that, because it was only a very short period of time in New York, Steve, but it was just, I don't know, it was like strobe lights, just blink, 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 of recognizing things. And in the faces of a lot of New Yorkers, you can see the future of America that you cannot see in busted knuckle Alabama. Okay, in the fact that, you know, people are walking hand in hand, whether they be two guys, two women, or a guy and a girl, it doesn't matter. You know, you see the future of America, and in that moment, you understand why it is that these weirdo fundy bigots despise places like, because when the fundies talk about, you know, America's going to hell in a handcar, you know, without fail, they will mention one of three places, or all three. They will mention San Francisco. They will mention Holly Weird, okay, or they will mention New York. You know, nobody ever says, you know, them homos in Richmond is going to destroy us yet. But the argument can be made, however, that it's the gay folks in Richmond that really are going to tear down the old structures.
Absolutely. I mean, think about Loving versus Virginia was about a Virginia couple.
Yeah. They're going to be their own undoing.
You know, a good example, like exactly what you're saying is, you know, marriage equality came to Iowa in one of the first places. It's things like that, and it's marriage equality. And you know, when the first couple in Mississippi gets married, and you see, and it starts to look like just a regular wedding. And you see their friends, and you see rice being thrown, and eventually when you get people kind of looking at it and going, wow, there's really nothing that crazy about it.
Well, remember, the Republican Party of Alabama had to threaten to throw out the president of the Young Republicans because she said she just really wasn't that worked up about the gay marriage. And they told her she could continue in her position as long as she didn't say anything more about the gay.
I'm going to say I don't get it. I'm going to say one last thing, and I want to get going because there's other people to talk. My partner is currently in school in Canada. And he has a lot of friends of his who are actually members of the Tories up there. Tons of gay folks are members of the Tories up there, Tory Party, the Conservative Party. And it's almost weird. You listen to them talk and listen to him. I've listened to him talk about it. And it's almost, I can't even describe how almost weird it seems that it's just not an issue. You don't have gay conservatives. You have conservatives who happen to be gay. You have liberals who happen to be gay. I see the similarities between what you just said with down in, you said it was Alabama?
Yeah.
Yeah. And with what's going on up in Canada where I think that's, and again, that's like you said, that's the future that a lot of those fundies are really scared of, is you have somebody right down in Alabama, the head of the college Republicans or whatever it was, saying, I'm not. I think we have other things to worry about, and that just really doesn't get me all that upset. And
yeah, I want to be weird about other topics besides gay people. We can be weird about all kinds of stuff. We're Republicans, after all.
Yeah, we have plenty of things to be weird about, and we do it every day.
And I mean, I've even got a just to kind of run a field with you for a moment, Steve. I got a story here out of Alabama, and it's a real horror show. It has to do with, you know, Alabama Stan, of course, could not tolerate the expanded Medicaid that socialist Kenyan usurper Muslim extremist with a deep-seated hatred of white people was going to impose upon Alabama Stan. So here's reality in Alabama where health care is concerned. The thing about Medicaid is states get to set their own Medicaid rules.
Sure.
So, for instance, in California or New York or some other states, Medicaid is much more accessible than it is in, say, Alabama. And here's how unaccessible it is in Alabama. Robert Bentley is the governor of the state of Alabama, and here's one of those run screaming into the night moments. He's a physician. You know, the way Paul Brown in Georgia is a physician, the guy who says that all science is lies from the pits of hell.
Pits of hell, yeah.
Yeah, he's got an MD degree. Robert Bentley does too. He's the governor of Alabama. He gave his State of the State address in January. And he said he didn't want Alabama to participate in the Medicaid expansion because he doubted the federal government could come through on its promise to pay for it. And the federal government can't afford it. Now, here's the governor of Alabama declaring what the federal government can and cannot afford. And he's the governor of a state that gets back ungodly amounts of, you know, for every dollar they send to Washington in the form of taxes, they get, you know, dollars back. But he thinks the federal government can't afford that there Medicaid expansion. So here's what it plays out as. The newspaper story tells the story of Tanisha Fields. She's 27 years old. She's uninsured. And she showed up at the University of Alabama Birmingham Medical Center because she was having problems following a miscarriage. She has a four-year-old little boy. Her earnings last year were $7,000 working at a cleaning service.
Oh.
Now, that means that she makes so little money that she can't qualify for federal help to buy coverage in the marketplace. All right?
Right, right.
But because Alabama rejected the Kenyan Muslim Medicaid expansion, it turns out that, and this is a sit-down, grab the duct tape and the tennis ball moment, Steve. At $7,000 a year, she is too wealthy to qualify for Medicaid in Alabama because anybody, a single parent with one child living in Alabama who makes more than $2,833 a year is ineligible for Medicaid.
Where the fuck do we live? I'm sorry to be crude. Where do we live?
I know, and you know this, and that question, Steve, is kind of on us, because we as progressives, liberals, whatever we care to call ourselves, have got to lead on this. We cannot wait around any longer. We have got to have universal single payer health care, or else we as liberals and progressives are just telling Tanisha Fields to go die quickly.
Yeah, we're telling her, just wait till next time, wait till next time, wait till next time. Let's get the...
I mean, $2,833 is a little over $200 a month.
A month?
And her upon being asked the question, she said, if I could buy insurance for $50 a month, I definitely would. But that's at $50 a month, for-profit insurance for Tanisha Fields would be 25% of her budget.
So what we're going to do is we're not going to give her anything, so she starts going to the emergency room, and it ends up costing 100 times what it would cost her just to give her Medicaid.
Right, and the reason I wrapped around to this story, Steve, is because while the right wing and the culture warriors of this country spend all of their time leaping past the hand-holding, as we were talking about, and are willing to go to marches and rallies, they would not go across the street for Tanisha Fields.
Nope.
And that is the searing indictment of this country and this system. And by the way, remember, Governor Bentley in Alabama?
Yeah.
He is a Christian of the First Order.
Well, of course. They take that stuff for the little children to say, make the little children suffer.
That's translated from the King James as, come on, y'all, let's go make the little children suffer.
You know, I tell you, Bob, I hear that story, and I think about what you folks are going through there in West Virginia, and I just...
Well, and Sandra just tweeted at me, Steve, and she said, I'm still trying to understand the Democrats cutting SNAP by $20 billion.
And I get so goddamn sick of hearing, Obama he had to do what he could. You know, I just wish people would, you know, we as progressives have failed, right? We're failing. And... elections are not the answer here. It's, you know, Malloy always says this about being in the streets, and I hate to say it. I don't know. It's not going to change until we're in the streets, and I fear what my biggest fear is that what's going to happen is when people, like, I don't remember her name, the woman in Alabama you just mentioned, when mothers and fathers can't feed their children, I don't want to be there. I don't want to be in that position, but we seem to be on a collision course with that position, if not already arriving there. And God help, you know, any right winger when a mother who can't feed her kid or a father who can't feed the kid is standing in front of them ready to beat the crap out of them. I hate to be so crude about it, but what is it going to take? I mean, I find myself with this all the time. I'm hearing a lot of what you're saying, and maybe I'm way off topic here, but I'm sitting there in housing court today, and it was a study in class and race, because as I walked into that courtroom, who do I see sitting there? All black folk. Who walks in, walks to the front, and sits where the quote-unquote landlord lawyers sit? This group of white folks. And I see this, and I see the stories you're telling. It's all the same thing. It's all the same thing. And I think about what the right wing is doing by dividing people along race lines, by dividing people along gender lines. And I just wish those of us in the trenches, those of us who are the quote-unquote 99%, would start looking at this and seeing what they're doing is they're dividing us with their lips while putting their hands in our pockets and stealing from us, and got all of us so convinced that
they've got white folks convinced it's the black folks, and they've got straight folks convinced it's the gay folks, and we as the majority or the not, whatever we are, need to really wake up and see that that's not what's happening here. It's the rich folks taken from the regular folks. And until we begin to see that,
we're done. Yeah.
We're done. Put a fork in it. And I'll tell you what, I sat there in that courtroom day. I was the only white guy on the tenant side of things, and it just made me realize this is not about race. I mean, that's a big part of it. It's not, I don't want to say the main part. It's class.
It's always class. It's always class. Racism was created on this continent out of class, not, do you see what I'm saying? Because,
of course,
you know, there was a lot of indentured white servants who were beginning to figure out that they had a lot in common with the black slave population, and the idea of white supremacy was invented to make sure that nobody perked up and went, wait a minute, they got money, we ain't. And by the way, Darlene just sent in a note, subject line, Steve, feet in the streets. Darlene says, feet won't be in the streets until we truly hit rock bottom, and we are very much on our way, you know, which is part and parcel of what I've said. You know, cable on, ain't no feet in streets. I mean, I got a story here that, you know, fit to make you scream. We know how many children have been bullied, right? And we know how often it is over perceptions, sexuality or perceptions of sexuality. Well, bless their little, you know, sometimes I'm grateful for this because we get to see them the way they really are, as if Duck Dynasty didn't pull back the curtain. Well, now we've pulled back the curtain and we've put the loop around it and tied it off so it just stays open. Enter R. Lee Ermey, and I know you know who he is. He catapulted to fame out of Full Metal Jacket. You know, what are you doing? Private Pyle, what are you doing to my beloved Corps?
Right.
He has declared, and I bring this up because no matter how badly the rest of us want to get away from being hung up on sexuality, the other side just stays there. So R. Lee Ermey has a book out to hustle now, and he did an NRA interview and has now declared that the reason children are bullied, is because all the young boys have been neutered. Because the answer to bullying is more violence. In this interview, he says, we've got little kids committing suicide because somebody bullied them in the schoolyard. You know what? I was bullied when I was a kid, but I tried diplomatically to get out of the situation. If that didn't work, then I would resort to force. I would pop the guy in the snot locker, drop him down on the deck, and he would think twice before he came and bullied me again. You know?
These are the people saying we need more guns in schools to keep guns out of schools.
Right.
You know, I wish someone would say, so does that mean everyone should be eating more fat to cure obesity?
Right. Right. And you know, if we could just, instead of having less violence in schools, maybe if we just had more, there'd be less bullying. The logic is mind-boggling.
Well, there is no logic. It's like it never occurred to him, well, why don't we just stop the bullying to begin with? Why don't we have teachers and administrators who say to kids to do it? No.
No, because see, when you do that, that means you're violating their Christian principles because the Bible says you have to hate the gay.
Yeah, I know. Those the poor Christians who are...
And they've got a First Amendment right to hate people. I never read the First Amendment that way, but I guess I'm just strange. Hey, Steve, I'm going to try to get a couple more calls in, but it's awful good to hear from you. We have great conversations when we talk.
Yes, you take care of yourself, okay? And keep the faith there. I think about you folks in West Virginia all the damn time, Bob. Oh, my God, I just... I can't imagine how exasperated you guys feel down there, and I feel the same way. I feel like, God damn, what is it going to take for people to say that these are our fellow...
Well, the sad thing here in West Virginia is I get the sense, and maybe it's an artificial sense, but I do get the sense that people are ready to stand up to these people, to these corporate thugs and whatever we want to call them, but there's no damned leadership. I mean, for so long, the only way some elements of people that we otherwise agree with know to do anything is to either hold up a burning candle or carry a crudely crayoned sign. And you know, I hate to say it, but the power of the people is often manifested in making the power structure understand that you're really serious about this and you're not going away.
Yeah.
And there are only so many choruses of Kumbaya. Well, I've never seen Kumbaya do anything. You know what I mean?
I hear you.
But people are getting ready. People are ready to move. They just have to sort of have a little help in what direction.
Well, I'm from Ohio originally. I drove through wild and wonderful West Virginia for so many times on my way back from D.C. to Ohio when I lived there, and what a goddamn beautiful state. And it just breaks my heart to see what's happening to people there. It just breaks my heart, and how people don't see, call it what it is, like you said, the poisoning of an entire population, and how Massey and people like that, how are they not terrorists? I don't know.
Well, because to paraphrase the old saying, they may be terrorists, but they're our terrorists.
Yeah, I was just going to say, yeah.
Steve, have a good night.
Take care.
All right, you too.
It's okay. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Steve calling from New York. Thanks going out to Asa and to George. Between them, they have met Randy's challenge, and all of us are very grateful for that. Thank you very much to Asa and George. That leaves us... George with a note, Bob, keep at it. So many morans, so little time. Oh, I know. I got a list of morans. I could go for another 6 hours. That's okay. We'll do a work in on Titanic Tuesday. But that leaves us $115 to go to meet tonight's fundraising goal and be out of the hole by start of the program tomorrow. So thank you very much to Randy for the challenge, and to George and to Asa. Thank you. Back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Hey, Jim. Or, I'm sorry, Bill.
You got us confused here.
Too much gin on the ramen for dinner, I'm afraid. Hey, Bill.
Yeah, how are you doing?
I'm pretty good, I think.
Quite a conversation and quite on the money, too. I mean, I woke up this morning to... And I don't have my Sea Crane radio back yet. I mean, I hope it still works, but because that's a... You ever see one of those things?
Oh, yes.
Don't ever hit anybody with it. It was working when those guys moved, and one guy's been playing around with it and this and that, and I finally told him, look, why don't you take it into my buddy over here that this owns this electronic repair shop, and let's get it checked out by somebody. I just said, you know... I told my buddy, I said, look, I knew an awful lot about that stuff, but I can't do it anymore. But, you know, when you're just experimenting with stuff, you're so behind the eight ball that you'll never catch up. And then I found a box of CDs missing that I had already worked and paid to replace a lot of stuff when it was stolen, and I can't find it. Oh, well, so here goes some calls out to, there's a record store in Alameda, or in California, that just, you can lay your hands on this stuff like it's nothing, you know. Unfortunately, they charge you for it, but that's life. But, yeah, my first thing this morning was listening to this talk about a football player. You know, Bob, years ago I learned that what somebody does with their life is their situation, and that's all there is to it. And, of course, you know, you can't get past the stupidity of people who try to tell you this is a matter of choice.
Yeah, and I mean, it's become automatic with me. I don't hear that so much anymore, Bill, but when I do, it's out of my mouth before I can stop it. When did you choose to be straight?
Well, I like to tell people, well, when did you plan to be stupid?
Hey.
Because that's, you know, I don't have all the answers to everything. All I know is what my own situation, and you know how I actually had a situation where a guy, we were playing a joint, and the guy kind of half hit on me, and I was in, Jesus, Bob, I was in my 60s. And I laughed, and I said, you know, that hasn't happened to me since I was a young kid, any fella propositioning me. And I said, my feelings are, you know, I don't mess around with men, because if I was messing around with men and women, I'd have nobody to get along with anymore.
Right.
And so, you know, I try to make the point with a little humor involved.
Sure, and, you know, you remind me of the dialogue in the Symposium, where Plato writes about Alcibiades hitting on Socrates at this, you know, drunken dinner party. And, you know, there's no passage in there in which Socrates says, you know, I want to kick your ass.
No.
He just said, no thanks, and everything went from there.
Huh.
And so when these guys, you know, I don't know what's going to happen in the locker room. Well, why is there any reason to think anything's going to happen in the locker room that hasn't already happened? Because there have, as sure as God made little green apples, we know this to be a fact, been gay NFL players. They just didn't dare come out.
Come out because they, well, there's a book called America's Game, and it's based, I got it on Talking, so it's been around, and it
you might remember this, Bill. Who was the gay player with the Packers, or was it the Redskins when he went to the Redskins? Lombardi knew the guy was gay, and just put the word out: leave this guy alone. He's doing a good job. I don't care what happens, except for what happens on the football field.
Yep.
And if you don't get the job done, we'll get your ass traded.
Yeah, if you know.
But is that apocryphal, or did that really happen?
I don't know. What I know about Lombardi was that he and the coach from the Dallas Cowboys, the guy with the hat, what the hell was his name?
Landry.
Landry. They worked for the New York Giants all through the 50s, and they had one guy they were chasing, but unfortunately they were on a treadmill, and they were chasing Paul Brown. They were trying to, because, you know, the Eastern Division. I mean, people don't realize that the Browns won the East every year from 50 through 55. Now, that's, you know, I mean, I know things were different because the league was smaller. So, and you know, but Paul was way ahead of people in so many areas of coaching and the skill level of the players. The Browns of the 50s were like the 70s Steelers. How many men did each team put into the Pro Football Hall of Fame? A lot of them.
Yeah.
And Chuck Noll had been a messenger guard for Paul. He had been a linebacker for a while, and then he moved him to guard because what Paul did was dictated the plays, and the guards carried him into the quarterback. So here's Noll. He was running every other play, you know, into the quarterback. And, of course, most of the time it was Graham, which means you're running plays into a tremendously talented person. And he was throwing the ball to two guys. Max Speedy was one. And Speedy quit and went to Canada because the money was better. And Dante Lavelli was the other, and they're both in Canton, both in the Hall of Fame.
Oh, I just found the Lombardi story, Bill.
Yeah.
It was 1969. It was at the Redskins, and Lombardi had at least 5 gay men in the organization, 3 players and 2 front office execs.
Yeah.
And according to a book, a biography on Lombardi called When Pride Still Mattered, upon his learning that he had a gay player on the Redskins, he looked at his assistant coaches, and he said, if I hear one of you people make a reference to his manhood, you'll be out of here before your ass hits the ground. That's 1969. So all of these anonymous sources at Sports Illustrated can go pound sand.
Well, my second father-in-law, who was a Marine, as I said, he fought on Saipan, Iwo, and Tinian. And so he saw his share of bullets flying. And he said it was never, he said he knew that there were guys in the outfit who were gay, but these guys could also shoot the crap out of somebody else and were good performing Marines, and it made no difference to the other guys because, you know, all this fear, well, you know, they'll hit on him in the foxhole. My ass, you know.
Yeah, please.
You know, these guys were so busy trying to
survive. But that raises a larger issue, Bill. I despise any foxhole mentality or any foxhole analogy. There are no atheists in foxholes. Bullshit, okay? And you know what? There aren't any atheists in foxholes, and there aren't any Christians, there aren't any Jews, there aren't any Muslims, there aren't any anybodies in foxholes except people getting shot at trying not to die.
Amen. That's so much the truth. I'm working on that Gardeners of Salonica, and you know Salonica was in Greece.
Yeah.
And here, an Allied army landed there and pushed north toward the border with Serbia, and they, including a lot of Serbs, it was a English, French, an Italian division, and a Russian brigade of 5,000, and the rest were Serbs. And here. And at that point in time, Greece was neutral. Greece finally joined the Allies. And I didn't realize it from reading the book the first time, but there was a Turkish contingent aligned with the Bulgars and the Austro-Hungarians and the Germans, fighting, you know, trying to keep the Serbs out of Serbia. And that I said, my God, a Turkish outfit fighting... well, the whole thing when Turkey joined with Germany was interesting. And they were still calling it Constantinople at that time.
Well, in fact, it was called Constantinople up into the 1930s.
Uh-huh. That's when they made the change. That was, what was his name?
Kemal Ataturk?
Yeah. I think was it under his tutelage that they changed the name?
I think that was part of it, yeah. But it should also be remembered that when Mehmed II overran Constantinople, he didn't change the name either. In fact, he declared himself the Sultan of Rum, which was
Rome. Yeah.
Rome. He considered him, because the imperial throne had been occupied by everything except a duck up until that point. And whoever got the throne became the emperor of Rome.
Yeah.
And so he didn't see himself. Granted, there was a religious shift, but he saw himself as having fought his way to it, being the legitimate emperor of Rome.
Well, we don't teach history of Europe that well. Hell, we don't teach history of America that well. So
we don't teach history of 5 minutes ago that well.
The Turks came rolling up out of their bailiwick twice, and they were at the gates of Vienna twice.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's a goodly distance on a map when you look at it, to travel on foot and by horseback.
Right, and nobody, you can make an argument that nobody throughout that history was necessarily the good guys. They were all just competing to one degree or another for, you know, for power.
Yep.
And you're right about him being turned back from the gates of Vienna in her magnificent book. What is it? A mirror.
It was the one.
Distant that, mirror. Distant mirror.
Yes, I'd like to get that. I have to see if they have that in word print.
For well, me. I don't want to spoil it or anything. I mean, you kind of know how it ends anyway. But the individual about whom the book is written or on whom the book centers winds up dying in a failed crusade, and gets killed when he gets he dies waiting to be ransomed after he's captured after a piece of just hateful Christian butchery. That was shocking, and then what follows from that is an eye for an eye.
When the alleged First Crusade seized Jerusalem, from what I have been able to gather, the streets were red with blood.
Yeah, the Christians killed Jews and Muslims and everybody in between.
Yeah.
Yeah, to create the Kingdom of Outre-mer. Bill, I hate it, but we got to get out of here.
All right. Well, you take care of yourself. It's just pleasant. I've got to call a couple friends of mine that I have not talked much with since the return to life situation, and hang in there.
All right. We'll talk
you
soon, I
be
hope.
On the air tomorrow?
Oh, yeah. Going to be right here.
Catch you then, sir.
All right. Bye now. Our buddy Bill calling from Cleveland, Mr. Stress. And a little reminder, I will be joining Mike Malloy in about 9 minutes for an ongoing conversation regarding some of the ongoing miseries here in West Virginia. Thanks to Sal for chipping in this evening and helping out. That means that we're going to finish the evening at $110 to go to meet the beginning of the week's fundraising goal. Thank you very much, Sal. Thanks, George. Thanks, Asa. Thanks, Dennis. Thank you, one and all. And thanks, Randy, for the challenge. It is time to get out of here. As ever, I thank all of you for your participation and for the time that you spend, the finite, precious, irreplaceable time that you spend in this little ongoing discussion that we have. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thank you to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACHEACT.org. Go there to take action, and it's probably one of the best, if not the best, actions you can take to try to reverse the trends of destruction and death that obtain in Appalachia. Work on your member of the House of Representatives. Work on your senators. Let's get the AIC Act passed in the House and get the AIC Act introduced in the Senate. ACHEACT.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Rick Smith is next on the Horn.